Welcome to North Beats from North Beach. I'm Corey Luna, your host, and I'm broadcasting on this wonderful October afternoon as the Blue Angels are practicing for next weekend. I've been out of the loop a little bit late on uploading my podcast. October 5th, I went to Velocity in Seattle, Washington. Thank you very much, Tim Held of Podular Modcast and Ellison Wolf of Waveform Magazine for inviting me. I took a lot of photos with my friends, Dorian Gunnels and Matt Bidoff. We had a wonderful time. It was really great. Looking forward to next year. So this episode is, I interviewed Peter Nybor of Sencell, and we talked about the Sencell Morph, and we get into his background in college and coding. Hope you enjoy this episode. It's really fun, and there's going to be some performances coming up. Not particularly with Peter Nybor, but using a Sencell Morph coming soon. Stay tuned. If you feel like contributing to the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/northbeats to contribute to this wonderful podcast, which has been so much fun. We just come out of the electronic music scene that's inspired me. And over here in the Bay Area, San Francisco, and Oakland, check out the first Sunday of every month, Resonant Frequencies in Oakland, run by Kevin Friedrichsen, Resident, which is on the second Tuesday of the month. Maybe it's on the first month. Not sure anymore. So it's on a Tuesday. Over at The Laundry here in San Francisco, run by Frank Martin and Emery Peterman, a.k.a. Easy Puzzle. And also on the third Wednesday of every month, running strong for now 6 or 7 months, is Peaked. Check out more on the Meetup app for Peaked, or you can also look us up on Instagram under PeakedSF. And we also have a Facebook page for Peaked as well as an event. So you can check it out and make sure you make the next one. We've got some great performances coming up real soon in October, November, and December. I'm not going to announce the names just yet, but stay tuned, check out those links as well, and I hope to see you all out there. All right, we're here with Peter Nybor. Peter, thanks for coming by. Really appreciate you coming over here.
Yeah, it's good to do these things face-to-face when possible, so.
It is.
Wanted to make sure that happened.
So, thanks again, man. So, it was kind of funny because I remember meeting you, I think it was here in San Francisco sometime last year, and you and I were, I think you were playing a show at Resident in San Francisco.
Right.
And you played there, and I was really impressed with, you know, the equipment you were using, and then I ran into you at Synthplex like 3 months ago.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I remember you're like, oh yeah, I saw that show. And it was like, whoa, you were like one of 10 people.
Yes.
and the five performers.
Yeah.
But that was really fun because I had been putting that stuff together, you know, and it's like, I really wanted to, it was nice because it's like, I like to play live, but I don't, you know, seek it out. It's not my career, you know? Yeah. And I just kind of like to have those things fall in my lap. And so it was like, oh, this fell in my lap. I'm going to do this. So it was really fun. It was good because it was like, it's a low key situation like
yeah.
that. And I haven't gotten up to a Resonant at, in Oakland.
Oh,
yet.
Resonant Frequencies?
Resonant Frequencies. Yeah. So I really want to do that one, hopefully in the next few months. It's a great place to just test things out. And it's like the idea of having an open mic, you know, where it's like a really diverse group of performers and, you know, it's like, if you make a mistake, like no one's going to, it's just very low pressure. So it's
it
like,
is.
You can test like, things out and that's really important. You know, it's like comedy, you know, and it's like hard to do with music because people kind of have these expectations either the club wants to sell drinks, you know, or, you know, people have an expectation of what they want to hear or something like that. And so you have to meet it. Whereas like, you know, open mic comedy, you know, most people do terrible. So
do you have experience with this?
No, I don't, but it's, you know, and I don't, I just like used to listen to like the Marc Maron podcast. I used to listen to that kind of regularly. And, you know, they would talk about, he has a lot of comedians on there and they talk about that. So it just makes a lot of sense to me. So,
okay,
yeah,
very cool. Yeah, so Resonant Frequencies and Resident, again, are great platforms for, you know, just experimentation and just bringing new material to an audience that is curious to hear what you're playing. And it's been, to me, I really enjoyed both of them. I've gotten to know a lot of the people who run those each, and I actually started a show called Peaked with my friend Rich Hogben, where we get together once a month on the third Wednesday of every month. And actually we did our third show last week, I think it was, the week before, and we're gonna have our fourth show next month in July, and where we're actually showcasing two musicians at a time, where they perform and then I interview them about their set
for a little bit. Oh, that's awesome.
And it's been a lot of fun so far. And the people who run Resident and Resident Frequencies have all come together and are supporting what I'm doing as well.
That's great.
What Rich and I are doing together. So it's been fantastic.
You're doing that here in SF?
Yeah. Okay. We're actually doing that at Supply Frame, which is on 3rd and Bryant.
Oh, okay.
So I'll give you the flyer for it later today.
Yeah. It's funny because I've kind of been longing for that because I live down in San Jose. And San Jose, you know, I've been there for about... like 14, 15 years now.
Wow.
You know, and it's like I moved there from Oakland, and in Oakland there was just this nice, vibrant scene at the time for like experimental music, and then also, of course, in San Francisco. And it was a great place to like throw ideas out and just, you know, play them out in front of like friendly ears and things like that. And, you know, you could really just sort of stretch out doing experimental things or whatever was sort of like, you know, eating at you, or, you know?
Yeah.
And coming down to San Jose, it was just like, man, there's just no scene here, you know? At least, you know, not the type of scene I was interested in. And I remember when we first started, you know, going to like restaurants and bars in San Jose, it was just, I'd look around and be like, what is holding this place together, you know? Because it's like, you go to a bar in San Francisco and they're sort of like, you know, it's like you kind of get a sense of a community there or something like that. And in San Jose, that just wasn't there. It was like, there'd be like a surfer dude and an engineer guy over here. And, you know, and so it was kind of cool because it was like, in some ways it was like, oh, there's a lot of like, you know, cross-pollination and in just in terms of like physicality, I guess.
Yeah.
But it was like, well, where do I go if I'm into the XYZ? But I think there's some, you know, people down there who are into synths. And I think like, given the right amount of attention and energy, I think there's some scene I think that could start to be built out there. So hopefully that happens over the next couple of years, because spending 2 hours to drive up to do a half hour set is a little bit
sure. Yeah. But and it's crazy because everybody that I know that's in the South Bay or San Jose area are coming up to here, like Mark Lechner, who does Electric Kitchen,
right?
And who else is there? There's a few other people.
Tim
as well.
Tim Thompson, Danny Kim.
Yeah. Jim Drones, which I don't think he's performed in a while. I know he's out in San Jose, but with his, you know, personal life, I think he hasn't had too much time to really be back in the scene.
Yeah,
but I know he's down there.
Yeah, but yeah, it's great. You know, it's like I think there is just sort of something in the air too about, you know, trying to create like physical meetups and places for these for this music to happen, and these instruments like electronic music, synth. Particularly, you know, a lot of these things are sort of modular synth as a hub, not a requirement. There's been over the past 10 years the explosion in like Eurorack and synthesizers and synthesizer hardware has happened, but there hasn't been a sort of correlated explosion in places for those things to be heard.
That's right.
You know, and I think, you know, there's also just sort of like social media has failed us, I think, and I think that is in the zeitgeist. And so it's nice that people are like, oh wait, we could actually like be in the same room.
Yeah, it's been pretty great because, well, I sought it out, you know, 2 years ago when I was feeling the hunger for you know, the camaraderie.
Yeah,
I went out and started trying to find things, and the first thing that came to my attention was Resonant Frequencies. So I went there for the first time in, I think, April of 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still, you know, relatively new. Wasn't, you know, I don't think it had been a year yet, I think. Not quite too sure about that, but I'll talk to Kevin about that. But, and then Resonant happens was starting, I think, just after Resonant Frequencies began. So I probably showed up at maybe like the third like show that he did.
Yeah.
And so I've been trying to go there regularly, and not as much Resonant Frequencies, just because I don't have a car. It's just a bit more of an inconvenience to get there right now. Yeah. But I've been able to hitch a ride with Matt Bidoff once in a while, who's one of the guy who does the photography for it.
Oh, yeah. The photos are fantastic.
Yeah. He does a really good job.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because it's like I get a lot of, you know, I just, my line of work, because I work in music products, music technology products, I go to a lot of trade shows and things like that. I just got back from Superbooth.
You got the shirt for it.
That's right. I'm wearing the Superbooth shirt.
It's great.
and, you know, that is really a, that's a really unique event, you know, because it's a trade show. But it is, it's like massively modular synthesizers and so many of the boutique manufacturers. It's all, you know, a lot of Europeans out there too, being in the middle of Europe in Berlin. And they hold it at a really unusual location, which just gives the place, you know, that extra like architectural vibe at the Fez Berlin. And they have like workshops and they have like, you know, performances and the manufacturers, like, it's coming, you know, working with Sensel, like I see, you know, I get the opportunity, like, because we had a booth there and it's like, oh, well, you can pay a little extra to do a little performance, you know, and instead of like most trade shows, it'd be like, okay, well, we'll give you a stage where you can talk, you know, and you demo or whatever. And they put this strict thing. It's like, okay, you have 20 minutes, but you have to play music for 15 of it, you know? Yes. And so it's like that, just sort of that type of requirement, it just like puts a much more cultural vibe on the show. And it just is like it's a really great meeting place for, you know, this type of the electronic culture and modular culture. And I think that, you know, like Synthplex, where we met last, that's something that they're trying to foster, I think, you know, it definitely is a contrast in, you know, like I said, architectural vibe, you know, because that's at the Marriott in Burbank, which is, you know, it's, the facilities were very functional, but they're not groovy, you know, whereas
that's right, yeah,
you know, whereas like in at Superbooth is like on the other end of the spectrum, where it's like, well, it might be kind of hard, you know, to get out there, and it's hard to like you know, the space is all weird, and it's open to the public for other parts, so there's like a swimming hall and playgrounds.
Wow.
And yeah, so, you know, it's a little bit, you know, disoriented in that regards, but like once you settle in, it's like, oh, it just oozes all sorts of vibes. So yeah
I haven't been to Superbooth yet, and that's something that is on my bucket list
for,
you know, maybe next year.
And it's just like, it's great because it's like there's, you know, a whole circuit of these things, and they're expanding again, like,
really.
Not Superbooth, but I mean just like the sort of like this desire to meet in person and show these things in person, and to cross-pollinate in person, you know, it's just, as there's been a growth in, you know, sort of like digital interaction, we've also seen a lot of growth, like Synthplex is new. And I noticed there's a lot of smaller synthesizer meetups in Europe and like Italy. There's a couple, there's one in like Florence and Turin. And then a lot of like the music trade not music trade shows, but like music festivals also have like a conference and trade show component. So like Amsterdam Dance Event, Sonar's always kind of been big on that, and MuTech's expanding to a lot of different a lot of different cities, and that's part of what they do. There's an educational component, or, you know, just sort of like a educational and cultural component that's outside of just like going to shows at night. So yeah, it's cool to see how these scenes are sort of changing, and, you know, sort of what's pushing that.
What did you think of Synthplex, how it was structured?
Well, it's hard to say because it's like I'm there as a manufacturer, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, my concerns are different from the attendees who's there. Because like when you're showing a product, you got to set it up. You know, you have just like this whole other layer of like to-dos. And then you have to be at the booth or traveling around and, you know, seeing what's new on the floor and seeing, you know, and just meeting up like with this community of, you know, all the people who make music products, you know, because that is, having been in the business for a long time, it's like, it is a very real community, and it's just great to say hello and you make friends, you know, much more so than I would if like I was selling like, you know, CRM software. Like,
yeah,
there's a lot less to bind you there. So, I mean, from that end, like everything, you know, my table was ready, you know, like all the things that like you need, like it was there and like all the expectations were met. I feel like, you know, the foot traffic could have been better for us for, mm-hmm. you know, as far as the show floor, but it was cool because it reached out to a very different crowd, than, you know, say like, say like Superbooth, for example, or NAMM. It was a lot of it was focused on, you know, being in Burbank. It was like people who were doing film and TV and, you know, actively working in production, you know, and people who were doing music, it was usually in service of some other part of another production. It wasn't necessarily like people who were just like, I'm, you know, making music for the sake of music. Mm-hmm. There, I mean, there's definitely a lot of that, but, it was interesting that there were so many film and TV people there, and it's like, oh, that's cool. Like, I don't get a chance to like corner those people and understand like where they're coming from a lot, because that's not my world. So yeah. I mean, so that's cool. It's like it's a different community, and I think it offers a lot of, you know, potential for growth.
Yeah, and that was something that I really was impressed with Simplex, that there was such a variety of people that are within, you know, that are within the trade that are using these, you know, the equipment and technology for different purposes.
Yeah,
for example, I went in one of the last talks I went into on that Sunday morning, there was a lady who's been working in sports for maybe, I don't know, 30 plus years, and she had a talk with a PowerPoint that talked about where the microphones are set up in the ground around a baseball field, and I had no idea.
Right.
But she's showing like these beautiful pictures of what the van looks like that she's in all day with like one or two other people running the audio and the video all at the same time as it's broadcasting live.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful picture of all these cables plugged in row for row, and there's a zip tie around them. And she says that person spent a lot of time doing that, and that's he's a little neurotic probably, but it's done really well.
Yeah, you're right.
So
yeah, that is funny, because that is that sort of like, I know, you know, as someone who's been, you know, working with electronic music and, you know, music programming and music software and music hardware, you know, I learned this stuff in 30 years ago. Right.
Yeah.
So I went to UC Santa Cruz and kind of got into the electronic music studios there. And it was just a great little program for discovering things. And, you know, I find that, you know, having worked with technology for so long that like a lot of times I'll go to a show, and if I'm not completely immersed in it, I'm trying to engineer what's happening. You know, I'm like, what is that gear? You know, how did they manage to sort of pull this thing off? Are they doing, you know, it's like, I'll start my brain will start trying to like, you know, analyze and sort of deconstruct like what's happening on stage. You know, and with, you know, a sports broadcast, I don't think about that, but it is as much, if not more, a part of it as, you know, it's like a Broadway show or, you know, or a, you know, huge pop production. It's like, it's a massive effort, and sound is an incredibly important part of that, you know, making it an enjoyable experience to watch a baseball game on TV.
Yes.
If you're into that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so. Like, yeah, again, it's like, it's not my thing, but it was fascinating just to hear, you know, the setup and the tech and how they're using the technology.
Yeah, as an aside, like many years ago, I think it was like in the late 80s, there was a change in network coverage of football. This is a total tangent. Sorry for your audience if you don't care about this. I'll try to turn it into something that's interesting. I think it was like a change in TV contracts, and, you know, like football had always had been on multiple networks. And this is when Fox, the Fox network first came about, which was the late 80s. And they started broadcasting football, and they could broadcast one game or something like that. And they did it totally differently than everybody. They they close mic'd a lot of the action, and they're like, they wanted it to sound like basically the producer said had played the video games, you know, which were totally rudimentary compared to what they are now, but they were still quite involved and they had a lot of sound.
Yeah.
And he's like, I want my broadcast to be like that video game. And so that's what they did. They brought a lot of the sounds forward and, you know, made you hear the quarterback, you know, you'd hear his audibles, like you wouldn't know what he was yelling out.
You know.
Yeah. And you hear like the people hitting each other and Fox took over football.
Wow.
And it's like, I'm sure there's a lot of other political machinations that, you know, and money trading that makes things like that happen. But in terms of audience appreciation, it was the sound, I think, that really kind of like took it to the next level for people.
It brought the audience in more to actually captivate, you know, the energy and effort that goes into, you know, playing a game like that.
Right. And I think that's like, I turn around to the audience, you know, like I think that's an important facet of, you know, music making on stage. And like, I think watching a modular performance, like sometimes it is sort of like you're watching somebody meditate.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be with laptops, you know, back in like when those first started becoming performance instruments, it was the joke was like, oh, someone's just checking their email. Cause they're using this industrial appliance, this work appliance for, you know, creating unusual art. Sonically you could hear everything, but you're like, oh, what's going on?
Yeah.
some like very kinetic modular performers like Caitlin Aurelia Smith. I don't know if you've ever seen her live.
I know of her. I've never seen her live.
Yeah. So live, she's amazing because she is, she looks like she's, you know, handling like, you know, it's almost like watching a telephone operator from the 60s handling a national emergency, you know,
really,
because she's patching, she's tweaking, she's singing, she has foot pedals, and she has a fairly large system that she's working on. It's not just a small suitcase that, you know, she's working on. She's very kinetic, and it's really engaging to watch. You know,
she just played in San Francisco like a month or two ago, didn't she?
I don't know. Maybe. Actually,
I think she did. I can't remember. I think she was at the mezzanine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she, she did. Yeah. So she's like, she's super kinetic. And her music is just extremely like, it's very complicated. You know, there's a lot of things going on and, you know, so it's hard to figure out like what is playback and what's live, you know, but it's like, she's very busy. So
I think Waveform Magazine, they just put out their first issue, and I think they actually have a full interview with her.
Oh, you're thinking of Suzanne Chani.
I am thinking of Suzanne Chani. Someone else, sorry.
Suzanne also, but yes, also very kinetic. Not as kinetic as Caitlin, I would say.
Okay.
But she does. There's just a lot of like patching, and she makes sure that you see it. You know, she puts a big video on the wall. And yeah, I saw that show and it was fantastic. It was a quadraphonic presentation, pretty much almost all Buchla synths.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was funny because like I remarked to someone, I was like, it had a really old school vibe, you know, like in terms of the old school synthesizers. I mean, because she's using vintage Buchla stuff.
Yeah.
And she's been doing this for a long time, you know, and she's gone through a lot of transitions. But yeah, you kind of get the feeling of like the you know, when people were just experimenting with these things for the first time and spouting out noise and doing it on a quadraphonic system, man. And but the real difference is that like the speakers, man, they can handle the transients of this old stuff. You know, they can handle like going from high to low really quickly, and they just sound phenomenal. So it was just, that was a real like pure sound treat. I really enjoyed that.
Are there any particular speakers you use at home?
No.
That you prefer?
My speaker situation is kind of sad, really. Like, I mean, I have like a decent subwoofer, and then I have a couple like small Presonus monitors that I use. But I have a 10x12 office. I don't need...
That's tiny.
Yeah, I don't need a really big sound reinforcement. So, but it is like I have some mixes on music that I hope to release in sometime in the next... I'm just gonna say year. and it's really like it's funny. I listen to like, I'm like, oh, it sounds really good in here. I take it to my car and it's just like, oh man, there's so much work to do.
Yeah, that's a big difference. Listening to what you've recorded, taking it out of your studio, putting it in the car, putting it on headphones, and sonically it's just completely different.
Yeah.
And it's such an ordeal to try to get everything to sound how you want it to sound.
Yeah.
On multiple different audio devices.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, to me, it's like, I'm not an engineer, but it seems to me like a such a tedious task that you may as well just design it to sound really good on great speakers. Yeah. And if it doesn't sound that great on the rest, oh well.
Yeah, you're just gonna have to like sort of, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, that's why people get paid to do this stuff, because they're willing to do that work. You know, it's just kind of finding that balance, because you do, I mean, it's a, you know, yeah, for some situations you're just like, you know what, my music is not for listening in the car. Yeah. So there. So
I think that's why there's I think that's how like Modular on the Spot came about, which is more of like an Oregon, Washington sort of thing.
Right, right.
But you know, a lot of it is just like people coming together and doing these performances with Modular, usually Modular, and you know, finding some space. And I think a lot of it is actually like in a park or you know, somewhere in nature.
I think they do that in Los Angeles too.
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, that is intriguing for sure. I think they do stuff in the LA River.
Yeah. That makes sense.
I know, right? So, yeah, that's a very good idea. I remember at Moogfest a couple years ago. I haven't been for a couple years, so they probably continued doing this. But they had like a rotating cast of like, you know, there's an outdoors. It's an outdoor stage, but it was kind of like, yeah, this sort of like rotating cast of players doing modular stuff outdoors, and it was more of a park like setting. And it's just, yeah, it's just a nice way to. You know, like mm-hmm. It's a nice way to enjoy it, because it's like it, I don't know. There's something, you know, organic about the fact that so much of this music is improvised, and, you know, being outside and sort of interacting with it in an outdoor scene is like, I don't know. I think there's a good vibe to that. You know?
Yeah. And I think it kind of goes back to what you said about a lot of these modular performers are in a state of meditation.
Right.
And I think that goes very well with performing outside.
Yeah. And there can be a lot of cognitive overhead on these things, you know, just like patching and, you know, yes. And just like trying to like, you know, figure out like, okay, what, you know, what knobs are going to be good for this, and mm-hmm. just getting to know your system. And I think that also contributes to some of that too. It's just, you know, achieving that sort of virtuosity where you can be very kinetic with it, you know. Or I should say, you can choose to be kinetic with it, because it's like mm-hmm. you don't have to. Yeah. I think really it takes a lot of time, you know.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
you have to take time to understand the system you're investing in and building in this, and figure out what works with each module better.
Yes,
compared to the others.
Yeah, yeah. There's and the interfaces are like, I don't know. This has sort of been a thing that I kind of am always been fascinated by, and it's kind of driven a lot of the work I've been involved in, like, because I was working with Livid Instruments for a number of years, so I helped start that company with the primary partner Jay Smith and another partner Travis Redding. We started that like in 2004 and had a good like 10-11 year run there. Wow. And that was all hardware interfaces, and we were trying to do trying to solve that part of the problem. We were trying to solve was initially was doing live video. So we made mixer, you know, live video mixing and mixing software to control real time mixing of video clips and doing effects and things like that. So you could cut a music video, you know, at a concert kind of thing. Sort of like the basic premise of that. And then we transitioned into music because so many people wondered if our controller worked with Ableton Live. And so we sort of like kept, we're like, well, everyone's asking that. How about we start addressing that market more? And, yeah, so we were just, you know, really into trying to find different ways of arranging buttons, sliders, and knobs into ways that people could, you know, create a comprehensive performance on, you know, and, you know, make an instrument. And we all throw that instrument label around lightly, I think, a lot of times. We're willing to call kind of anything and that makes noise an instrument. you know, but if you sort of like, you know, you look at the history of, you know, playing an instrument like guitars and violins and flutes, they all kind of they stand on their own very well. So that's kind of what we were aiming for with our interfaces. And to sort of take people away from having to use a mouse and keyboard, and, you know, being able to be more like engaged with a device that was more suited to it. And yeah, and so I've continued that with Sensel, which is also kind of like another very different thing, because it's like, now we just have like this pressure sensor, and you can do what, you know, there's all sorts of possibilities with it. It can be one button, it can be 64, it can be a bunch of sliders, it can be a multi-touch device where it's not location, it doesn't matter where you touch it, you know, it depends on what number, which finger is being used at what time, and things like, there's all sorts of weird questions that come up, and it's sort of like this blank slate of tangible music interaction, I guess, that that is possible with these things. So,
with Sensel, I've seen you perform with it, and I got to check out and play around with it at Synplex back in March, and you had a video screen set up, which is basically, you know, kind of like a grid.
Yeah.
And like you could push on, you know, the pad, and you would watch the video as the plane would stretch out more and more as you know, with your pressure and moving around. And what I'm curious about with this is, you're with the technology and the development, and also, is there a correlation with Tim Thompson's work with his space table?
His palette,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's been doing, he jumped on the Sensel Morph Manowagon, like when the Kickstarter happened 5 years ago. Cause he had been looking, so just to back up, the Tim Thompson is an artist, he's based in San Jose. He has this instrument he's created called the Space Palette Pro, which has four pressure sensors, in this case the Sensel Morph, multi-touch, and they're all sort of divided up into these sort of ideas that he, I don't know if he really promotes the term, but he's thrown out the term of like time frets. So everything's sort of broken into a grid, but you're touching the just sort of a continuous surface. And it's affecting both the audio and video. So he has a large screen in front of you that's in, and then you have like a large sort of oval palette with these, you know, with the four Sensel Morphs that are each about the size of an iPad 2. And then you just run your fingers over them, and you're generating like finger painting visuals of different sorts and different music depending on sort of what presets you select. And it's really this sort of like insane experience, you know, because it's like you're just pushing around on these smooth plastic surfaces, and then all this stuff is happening. But you can make sense out of it, you know, like you can sort of decode like, oh, okay, when I do this, I get this result.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a bunch of whatever, you know, it's all highly correlated. He had been searching for the technology that we offered in the Sensel Morph for really kind of a long time. And we've enabled that because our device not only is just, it's a MIDI controller, it can be a keyboard, but we also have an API. So that's what he's using.
Okay.
He's just taking all the raw multi-touch information to generate essentially OSC messages for painting and for creating music.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So his development has been possible with the technology from Sensel?
Yes. And it's funny because our company's founder, Ilya, he initially had a company probably about 10 years ago that was called, I should know this. I want to say Touchable, but that's not right. But it was a multi-touch pressure sensitive technology. And it was on the market very briefly, and then it was bought by Amazon. And so when that happened, Tim had been, you know, he's like, oh, this is what I want, this multi-touch pressure-sensitive thing. I want to start building this space palette idea. And once it came off the market, he was just like, I only have two of these things. Oh. You know, he had like one or two of them, and he couldn't progress. So then he started working with, he did a bunch of other stuff that was, you know, like fully interactive type, you know, music, audio things. And then I started working with Kinect, using the depth sensing camera from Microsoft, using that to sort of create these ways of triggering music and visuals all simultaneously with your large gestures of your hands. And then when the Morph came out, he immediately backed that, and he was just like, okay, now I can finally build what I want to build. And that's the
wow.
the Space Palette is.
That's
yeah.
great. You know, I saw him again. I saw him play perform Resident as well, mm-hmm. and got to he was you know, happy to have anybody come up and touch the pads and see the reaction on the screen. And of course, I had to touch it. It was great.
Yeah.
So eventually, I need to go down to San Jose and chat with him. And I know that he's been doing meetups at his place, at his house, the Photon Salon.
Yes.
I think he's calling it.
Yeah. Yeah, and he only lives like maybe a mile away from me, but
really?
And I'm guilty. I haven't been yet, but it's, you know, that's how life is sometimes. But yeah, he's, so just to answer your question, like that thing that I had set up at Synthplex, which was a Max patch, where I was using the Max object. So we've got sort of got the API built into Max. So I could get all the multi-pressure and then just sort of visualize that really simply by, you know, the harder you press, the higher a peak shows up on that grid, and then tying that into a VST. So I was using the Quanta VST from Audio Damage.
Oh, cool.
Which is, it's a granular synth, so it works really nicely because it has a lot of odd parameters that you can attach your pressure and location to. And so yeah, you just kind of like put your fingers on and swipe around, and you know, and it looks cool and it sounds weird
does.
And I did a little performance with that at Superbooth in my little my lecture performance thing. So, it's very fun to play, and it's definitely, I have another thing that I did that was, it's a little bit different. And I showed this at CES that was straight up influenced by what Tim was doing, and where I had like these colorful circles that would, be displayed on a screen, and you'd sort of finger paint with those and, you know, press around with your hands. And then, each finger was sort of like a little different instrument, and it was all, you know, time-based, and, you know, everything was sort of locked to a grid. So yeah, that was straight up like, well, Tim's stuff is too bulky for us. And I'm like, well, I'll just whip this thing up in Max and, you know, and make it so. So it was a little bit easier to digest too. And in the madness of CES. So.
Because his equipment, like he brings, you know, he's got that, you know, custom built table with the pads set up in it. And then he's got, you know, what, like a tower PC.
Yes.
That everything is feeding in and out of.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a flute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's, you know, quite an effort just to, you know, set a gig up with that.
Yes. Yeah. And he does a lot of shows. He shows it, like to the public, and like anytime he gets a chance to like show it to the public around, he'll do that, and it's great. He did Sub-Zero
right?
in San Jose, which is like an art walk, you know, where the city streets are closed and they have a bunch of different artists showing stuff.
That's cool.
So yeah, he shows it there with a bunch of headphones, and yeah, people just come by and play, and they love it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Were you at Sub-Zero?
Yeah, I did. Sure. I walked around a little bit. You know, it's a bike ride away, so it's very easy to get to.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't get a chance to go. I knew of it, but I didn't have time that weekend to go down.
Yeah, it's a fun scene.
That's cool. How long has that been going on?
I want to say probably a good 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
In general, like an art, a variety of arts?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything from, it's kind of like, there's stages for music. There's you know, and then there's like artists selling paintings, you know,
okay.
And then, you know, and then people selling t-shirts, and then there's a lot of like community organizations that have like, you know, various like, you know, just sort of tents to get people to know them. And then, yeah, a lot of people like to walk around. It's sort of like a, you know, a lot of the South Bay Burning Man people are like, oh, I got another opportunity to use my LED outfits. And yeah, so it's like, it's kind of this festival of, you know, creative festival, like that is, you know, it's pretty easygoing. It's good.
That's great.
Yeah.
I need it. Yeah. It was one of those things. It's like, I saw it happening. I'm like, I need to get down there. I need to do this.
Yeah. Well, they do it every year.
Next year. Nice. Okay. I'll try to make it out.
Yeah.
That's great that they've been doing it for 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to hear about that.
Yeah.
And then, like, there's another thing that started happening in Illinois, NobCon, which I haven't made it out to yet. I almost went last year just because my girlfriend's parents live, like, a town or two over from Schaumburg.
Okay.
So I was thinking I'd go stay with them and it'd be easy to get over, and I didn't go. Maybe later this year. I think it's in September, right?
Yes.
I think it is.
Yes, it is. I haven't been to that either. And again, yeah, that's, I think it's a, it's another one of those small synthesizer shows that, you know, attracts a good crowd. And, I'm not sure when that started. I've talked to the suit and tie guy who's sort of he's the main organizer behind that show. But it seems like a pretty fun event. I've heard good things about it.
Cool.
And again, I think it's, you know, it's conferences, trade show. I don't know if they do DIY stuff. I would almost think you'd have to just cause it's a synthesizer event.
Yeah.
I learned about it at Moog Fest. You know, also that's also, you know, again, that's another example of like one of these synthesizer sort of community spots, you know,
yeah,
where, the trade show is just open to the public, which is nice.
Cause that's nice.
You know, it's great. Well, it's nice for the public for when you're boothing, it can be hard because
all these people coming up who have like no desire to like buy anything. They're just kind of curious.
Yeah. But you know, that's very important, you know, and those conversations can be very fun, and it's nice. It can be a nice break because, a lot of times when you're, you know, showing a product at a booth, you end up having the same conversation a lot. Like NAMM is very much like that. The smaller shows are much better in that regards because, they're just more focused and so the audience is just more in tune with what you're doing. You can kind of cut to the chase very quickly, and then, you know, they have a much better idea of how it's going to fit into their creative life. You know, they're like, oh, these, or they understand like, yeah, that's not for me. And then they'll move on, you know? So
yeah,
it's like, it's fun. And like, yeah, so you really do get a good, like, panoply of, you know, what people want out of these things. And it's kind of intimidating too, because you're just like, oh man, it's like, well, you want to address all of these like possibilities that people have, you know, but man, you gotta be focused, you know?
Yeah.
that's a challenge with the morph. Cause it does, like, it's like a lot of times the answer is yes, you can do that, you know, because it's like, it's kind of a blank slate of control. And so that is a challenge of like, well, you know, any product guy is going to, well, who's this for, you know,
mm-hmm,
give me the elevator pitch. And you're just like, ah, yes, you know, that's not what this is about. You know, you try to create it, but you have to some degree, just so people understand, like, they can attach themselves to something that they might imagine themselves using it with. But, yeah, it is funny. Cause it's like, well, it kind of defies that, because it's not like, oh, this, you know, headphones go in the headphones section and keyboards go in the keyboard section. And, you know, guitar pedals go with guitars, and, you know, it's not always so easy to do that with these sort of like, sort of genre crossing devices. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. Oh, Peter, I'm curious about, how did you really get into electronics and, you know, in the business that you're currently in?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely not a plan. I was at UC Santa Cruz, and I was working towards a math degree there, which was sort of just like, I never thought I would be getting a math degree, but Santa Cruz will do that to people. Turn someone from someone who's like more humanities based is turn them into a mathematician, and vice versa. So I discovered a friend of mine was just like, oh, you know, I'd always been sort of into guitar and guitar pedals. I'm not a very good guitar player, but I was into this stuff, you know, and a friend of mine was like, oh, you know, there's an electronic music studio here. I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, I'll show you around sometime. And so I got on that track, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't part of any major. It was totally like cross-disciplinary. So yeah, you had people from humanities, you had computer science people, you had electrical engineers, you had musicians, all in the same class, you know? So that was, I think, very, like, for me, it was very like, eye-opening, because you'd have all these different perspectives of what people wanted, you know, the problems that different people would have, different problems with this stuff, and people would get very different results, you know? And, but everybody was like, since people were kind of left to their own devices, literally, you know, you get really cool, good work out of that stuff. So, it really kind of like opened up the potential. And then I got into Max there. So that was, you know, it was Max when Max was with Opcode, it was just MIDI. And you could take, you know, keyboard events and MIDI events and just kind of like process them. And manipulate them and create generative things or interactive things. And that was one of those things I was like, a friend of mine was like, oh, you should see this. I'm like, I don't understand that at all. You know, which is probably like what happens with 90% of the people who see Max. And then one night I was in the studio and then like, I was like in the adjacent studio and I had to go get a cable like from the other one. And there was this guy working with Max and he had this whole patch that was using the mouse. And so he was taking like mouse events, you know, and using those to control, like send MIDI to all these different synthesizers, you know, which would have been like a Roland JD990 and a DX7 and, you know, Yamaha, like drum machine and, older stuff. And I was, you know, all through five pinned in. And I was just like, you know, he was running on Macintosh 2SI, I believe. And he was just getting these wild results just by, you know, moving his mouse around and clicking at different times. And I was like, okay, what is going on? And he just sort of took me through his patch. And
that's cool.
And I was like, the whole, like being able to like hear what Max could do was very enlightening. And then also like just, you know, that he had taken this like very perfunctory interface device that was designed for office work and completely subverted it and turned it into this, you know, wand of magic that was, you know, controlling all of these devices plugged in all over the studio. It was just like, okay, this is really, I really need to dive into this some more. Wow. And, so yeah, I got into Max at that time and started, you know, started doing like little generative things and, you know, incorporating it into tracks we were recording to tape. And so I got the bug with Max, got the bug with synthesizers and sound and the whole idea of being able to just, you know, manipulate sound. And I was really into Frank Zappa at the time. I still am, you know, but he was definitely like, you know, with a lot of other stuff, but Zappa was definitely like, he had all those different, he had so many timbres that he would work with. And then he got into electronic music and, you know, for a control freak like that, he was really, you know, he found a lot of like amazing plasticity in sound that was fascinating to me. So yeah, I just kind of like, I guess the nice thing about learning digital is that I could kind of like, I didn't have to assemble an expensive studio. It was like, okay, well, I already have this thing I need for work. I have this Mac software on it and I can get a couple of like basic synthesizers and I can just start doing all sorts of stuff, you know? Yeah. And then they came out with MSP, you know, in like 95 or something like that. And that gave me additional capabilities of working with sound and just, it Mac made it also plastic and made it so like, anything was anything, inputs were could output anything. It wasn't like this, the keyboard didn't mean anything anymore to me, the you know, like the neither piano keyboard or the QWERTY keyboard. It was like, okay, well, this button can do anything. It can do the tiniest little blip of noise, or it can, you know, trigger like a whole musical idea or concept. So yeah, that's where I that's kind of how I got into it. And then getting into the business was really just sort of by staying active in Max and being part of that forum, like the email forum at the time.
Okay.
And just asking a lot of questions and showing my work and, you know, different times, so I got to know people at the company and they'd be like, oh, someone needs help with their patch, you know, and they'd hire me for something. And I do a little bit of that. And then I started with Livid Instruments, where I met Jay Smith online, and he made this crazy MIDI controller, and he wanted to control video with it, and he needed software to do it. And so I was like, oh yeah, I can do that. And so just started like, you know, riffing on those ideas. And we're like, he went on tour with his rock band, where he was the video guitar player, right? The
video guitar player.
It's called the Viditar.
Oh, cool.
And so he and this rock and this band Cinch, and he was on stage with them as with all the other rock instruments, and they had two big screens and he was cutting video live, and like every, you know, they went on a nationwide tour for like 1 or 2 years, and like especially like all of the people, you know, all of the front of house people and the lighting design people and all of like the people in production were just like, I didn't even know you could do that. You know?
Wow.
And they're like, this is incredible. Like nobody had this capability and everybody thought it was amazing. So we're like, there's a business in this. So
yeah,
that's kind of when we just started slowly growing that company, and building it out for video, and then started going into music. And yeah. And so it's just doing that. You you know, it, we kept chasing the ideas, you know.
Yeah.
You just meet a lot of people, and it just sort of like, I got a lot of roots in the business, so.
That's amazing. Oh, you need another class?
Nah, I'm all good.
Okay. So with, now you're working with Sensel. And how long have you been working with Sensel
now? About 2.5 years now.
Okay.
So I came on with them right when they started to ship the product from their Kickstarter, because it took like 3 years to finish the product. And they had about, I think, 2,500 backers. So I came, like, I had met the founders when they first started, you know, just the two of them, Aaron and Ilya. And I met them at like a hardware meetup around here in SF. And, you know, and he's like, oh, I work on pressure sensors. And I was like, oh, well, I work with, you know, music devices, and we need pressure sensitive electronics. And I was like, let's talk, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, we got to know each other a little bit, but neither of us were ready to work together. And, yeah. And then eventually, like a couple of years ago, like I was looking for some work, and, you know, I'd been in touch with them, and, you know, got in touch, and I was like, hey, do you need help getting this thing to market? And it's like, where you're at with this. And so it was just kind of like making that transition from being a Kickstarter product to like something that would be sold like any other product, you know, a consumer product. So that's it's a very different buyer, very different challenge. And as I had the background from working with Livid for so long that, you know, I kind of knew the music industry. I know the music products industry really well. So I knew that there were certain things out of the gate that we needed to do with it. Beyond that, I mean, the Morph can do, I mean, it's not just a music device. It has like video editing, QWERTY, and gaming, and these other things it can do with it. But like the best value and the best showcase for that technology is music, because it's the most demanding, and they're the people who are going to get the most out of it. So that's kind of like where that's our destination for it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Like, I'm still fascinated with it, and I have, you know, I have yet to really do more research on deciding if it's, you know, something that I need to invest in for my personal use.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure yet. It's something that, you know, again, you know, I need to spend a bit more time just kind of looking at it and deciding if what its capabilities are what I'm looking for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, its capabilities are kind of endless.
and that's actually kind of intimidating.
Yeah, it is. It's really intimidating, for sure. You know, some people really like to chase that, and other people are just like, well, I just want to do this one thing. And you can go either way, but yeah, trying to like speak to both of those people and making sure that they're comfortable is like, man, that's a lot harder than I would have expected, you know?
Now, tell me about your setup when you played it, when you perform it live, like say at Resident, when you performed, what did you set up?
So at Resident, what I was doing, that was sort of my, oh my, sorry. There's a container ship that's just blowing my mind right now going through the harbor. That's a lot of stuff. Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's yeah, I see those all the time.
You can come across the Pacific Ocean on that, like, anyway. So, yeah, where was I? That was weird.
Yeah, they pass by Alcatraz all the time, man.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that. That's a great view. Where was I?
Your setup at Resident.
Oh, yeah, setup. So that was like
the Morph.
Yeah, so the Morph in that case was, I was using it sort of as an auxiliary. And the centerpiece of that, I was using my favorite Livid controller, which is the Control R, which is one of the most more unusual Livid controllers, because it was, you know, a lot of stuff we were doing was button grids and that type of thing. We had co-designed this with Richie Houghton in like 2011, I think it was, 2010. And so it has like a two rows of 16 RGB LED, you know, rubber buttons on the bottom. And then it has 8 channel strips of one slider and 3 potentiometers. It has a 4x4 grid in the middle, and it has 12 encoders, a 3x4 encoder group in the top center. And this thing it's kind of like this weird hybrid of like, you know, like a Roland drum machine, you know, step sequencer, all that type of stuff. Though it doesn't have any clock on itself. It's like, it's all designed to work with software. So we have like a suite of like Max for Live devices and, you know, and Ableton scripting and things like that, that kind of like allow you to sort of access your devices and do a bunch of sequencing on the fly. So that was like my hub, because I was doing sort of a techno jam with that. And so I was, you know, sequencing drums and bass with that mostly. The morph I was using as sort of like a, mostly I was using the music production controller, which is a 4x4 grid of pads and then some sliders and knobs. And then there's like a little key bed down there. And I was using that just as a way to like play, like ambient synth stuff, you know, techno, you've got your beats and then you've got your swoosh. And so that was like, a key part of my swoosh, you know, at some point in my set. And it's just, you know, it's just kind of like, it's, I was kind of getting like a theremin type effect out of it, you know,
because awesome.
I was, because it is, it's more of like a, because you have that extra pressure and it's really sensitive. It's kind of like a really like, get more like corporeal, you get more of your body into it, you know, than just like, it's a very different sensation than playing a keyboard or, you know, using knobs and sliders and stuff like that. So, yeah. So yeah, like as an auxiliary, and it's cool cause it doesn't take much room on the table. So you just throw it on there and you're like, I'm just going to use it for a little bit in the set and that's fine. It doesn't have to be the centerpiece.
Yeah. Cause I like the idea of, you know, with the technology available now, as you know, we're able to, you know, performers, musicians and even video, you know, artists are able to play a set and all their equipment can like fit in a backpack.
Yeah.
And I think that's fantastic.
Yes. Yeah, and especially if you're flying.
Yeah. It's so. Like, nope, you know, not going to check anything. It's a carry-on.
Yeah, for Super Booth, it was funny because, like, Super Booth, you know, we have a very small table there, you know, but I did a trade show on two pieces of luggage, right?
Cool.
You know, and but I had a full setup. Like, it's nice that they provide speakers, so that helps
That's
a lot.
That's good.
Yeah, so... But yeah, you know, it is the portability is things. It's like, oh, well, I can do my whole deal and, you know, on an international flight and not have to pay any additional luggage fees. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And like the Super Booth, like I did something very different from that set I did at Resident. And that was like, I did like these little vignettes where I was using, like I said, I told you that multi-pressure instrument that I did with Quanta and just kind of did like this soundscape type thing. And I did, and then I did some stuff with modular. So I had it going into the Expert Sleepers FH2, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a USB MIDI host and then spits out CV.
Yeah.
So I had the morph plugged into that and I was using the Thunder overlay, you know, it's just kind of a natural fit, right? You got to use the Buchla Thunder with the modular stuff. So yeah, I was using that to just sort of like, you know, again, using that pressure and being able to pitch bend and using the timbre controls, like instead of having to twiddle knobs, you just sort of have like these motions and gestures that are your parametric controls. So just running that through a synth, and then I had like some auxiliary stuff running in Bitwig, had some like beats and a couple other little things that playback type things, you know, and just to give me some background to do my noodling. So yeah, and that was definitely more like ambient and down tempo than doing a high energy techno set. So
very cool.
Yeah. And then let's see, the other gig I did recently was the Day of Noise, which is KZSU radio station down at Stanford. And that was that's all 24 hours of experimental music. And so
God, KZSU, I used to use their back in 99, 2000, mm-hmm. they had a section of their website that was dedicated to a variety of industrial music. And I was using it, and it was a database of just like names of different bands. And I was using that as research to basically teach myself what should I be listening to and branch out and experiment. Yeah. And of course, this is back when like Napster was a thing still, and you know, before he got sued.
Yeah.
So I was using that to find things with that website.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Sorry, please continue.
Yeah, yeah. So KZSU, they do this every year, like around February, and it's organized by Abra Jeffers, I think she started as a DJ there. I think she still has a show there too. I'm not entirely sure. I should know these things. So she just puts out a call to like Bay Area artist networks and, you know, noise musicians in the area. And, you know, sort of divvies up 24 hours of slots, so that's anywhere from half an hour to an hour. And it's, yeah, it's like acoustic groups, you know, it's noise musicians, people just doing, you know, sound art. And yeah, so it's just 24 hours of just great stuff. I always like to do the early morning. So
nice.
Yeah.
Very cool, man. So
yeah, and that one was, I kind of did like an ambient set, used the morph a lot to just sort of like, you know, drive sound and control it. You know, it's nice to, again, like having been a knob and slider guy for so long, it's nice to just sort of, I always like to call it like massage as a metaphor for music making.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, since I know what the pads look like, it totally makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, that's not a metaphor that, you know, most electronic music is sort of like organized around like these, all of these analogies and metaphors that are derived from previous instrumentation, right? So, you know, the envelope, the ADSR envelope, it's like, well, mm-hmm. okay, it's like it's computationally possible or electrically possible, and then you can form it so you can do a piano type thing. And here's how you shape it for a piano. Here's how you shape it for strings. Here's how you shape it for a snare drum. And, you know, and so it's like it's all organized around those ideas. And then the interfaces, you know, are a lot of times, and this is, I talk about this when I give a talk about like interfaces and electronic music a lot. It's like everything's derived from like wartime technology, right? You have mm-hmm. like all this stuff that was used to like drive tanks, to guide bombs and missiles, or calculate bomb and missile trajectories, and then all the like the sort of like trickle down technology that came from, you know, really World War II, is like we're still using that stuff, like knobs and sliders.
We are,
you know, and like we don't use it with any question, but it's like, yeah, this has death roots, you know.
And I think even the microwave was developed, you know, for military use,
right?
And now we use it in kitchens.
Yes. Yeah. So it's like, you know, and I think it's really awesome that, you know, that music has subverted all of that, you know, and turned this stuff into, you know, cultural expression, you know, means of cultural expression. But at the same time, I'm like, well, there are other modes, you know, especially with like the blank slate that computer technology and electronics offer us now. Like you can,
yeah,
there's so many other analogies that you can use, you know, that connect sort of, I think a lot of people were able to sort of incorporate dance as a music making interface. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not that's successful is, yeah. You know, you know, or the conducting, you know, using the conducting, that's also been a metaphor that's been chased a lot, but that's a music based, whereas dance is sort of, you know, just a different cultural expression. And so that's where I'm kind of like, oh, massage is an analogy for music interaction now. What other things can we do? You know, it's wide open.
And there was a video game that came out in the, I think the early aughts, maybe 2000, 2002, called Rez, R-E-Z.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was on PlayStation 2. I think it was on that.
Okay.
And it was... it was a vector game, and basically you just had a this floating character that over the levels your character would evolve into different shapes and forms, you know, starting out with a very simple humanoid looking character.
Uh-huh.
And it would morph into different shapes and forms, and the idea was you go through these levels, and again the whole thing is a huge vector that you're going through these different kind of universes. It's very techno, and
yeah.
And the way you go through the levels is you're basically mashing A or B, and you're creating music with every button that every time you hit something, it's creating music. And it was a very musical game.
Oh, wow.
And it was all based around, you know, these beautiful 3D vector designs and cool techno sounds.
I gotta find the YouTube videos of this, because that sounds really cool.
It's a fun game. It's a simple game, but it was really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny, because it kind of reminds, have you seen that new gaming platform? It's, at Panic and Teenage Engineering. Recently they've been showing some models of it, or prototypes. I forget what it's called. But it has, you know, it has like your little AB and your motion, you know, your basic game controls on the front, and a little black and white screen, some simple games. But it also has this crank on the side. Yeah, so there's like, you know, it's Teenage Engineering, so there's this little crank, you know, has a little handle on the side, and you turn the crank, and so that's that's a game control for some of the games. Yeah. And it was like, wow, that's great. It's very different, you know? Like,
yeah.
And it's a very, it's great that it's a simple device, but they're introducing this very novel concept. And it's like, oh, how will this be used?
It's kind of like how, it's kind of like maybe a little bit of a development on the pocket operators that they've been producing over the years.
Yes.
Like that one.
Yes.
Where it, and all the batteries in it right now, but you know, it basically, there's a little display with characters going on, but really you don't control that at all. It's just a cool little graphic.
It's, and it's amazing. Yes. Yeah. It's just like this sort of like, you know, visual input because they can, and there is some, I guess there is, I haven't really played with them that much, but there is some meaningful input on the screen, but
oh yeah, yeah,
there's also just a lot of
volume and, you know, BPM, things like that.
Yeah,
but overall, like the cool little graphics on there, like there's two boxers on the KO sampler,
yeah,
that are, they just do their own thing and you don't really control that.
Right, right. Yeah. And that's it's really magical. Like
it is,
it's like it has this animating spirit within it.
Yeah,
it's great. Yeah, I don't know. Interface, I think interface influences, you know, the worth of a lot of the things that, you know, that we choose to use on software particularly, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if it looks expensive, it sounds expensive. Even if it's the same compressor algorithm, you know, like who knows? You know, I always wonder about that. Like the Teenage Engineering, the what is their first device? Why am I blanking
on it? OP-1?
OP-1.
Yeah.
You know, that thing has just delightful animations for it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, that makes, you know, makes a big difference. Like a loop is a loop, right? But mm-hmm. like when it has that really delightful, like, you know, animation going on, you just feel like you want to keep working with it. You mm-hmm. know, you want to be closer to it. And it's just, you know, like, oh man, it takes a lot of time to make those things work. But
it does, but it's pretty, they're amazing.
Yeah. The payoff, I think, is quite incredible. That's an iconic device now.
It really is. Like I just was it last this month I had Yate come by, and his name is Josh, and he actually he performed at Pete this past month. Okay. And he used the OPZ,
yeah,
and, along with a MIDI box that was receiving signal from a plant that had a contact mic on it, sending that into the OPZ.
Okay.
It was so cool.
Yeah.
And yeah, he played a really fun set, and yeah. very like very kind of like Nintendo-esque sounds, like 8-bit.
Yeah, yeah, and, like
16-bit.
Chiptune type thing.
Chiptune stuff, yeah. Absolutely.
All right.
He played a fantastic set,
yeah,
with that little machine.
Yeah.
And it was really fun.
Yeah, and it's funny, in a world of like, you know, fakes and copies, like, I don't think nobody's really trying to out OP-1 the OP-1.
No.
You know, people are like, they're like, how do you branch from that?
Yeah. Know? If anything, they're kind of, you know, they've taken what they originally made and made it into an even smaller device and made it a little bit more affordable.
Yes. With OPZ.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is great.
Right. Because they outsourced the screen. They offloaded the screen to the yep. screen you have in your pocket.
Which yeah.
which is something that, I have to say, that was something that, like, sort of near the sort of, like, end of my time with Livid, that was one of the things I was really kind of, like, investigating. Like, I'm like, how can we leverage the screen that everybody has in their pocket? Because we didn't have screens on our controllers. And, you know, we're starting to get the heat a little bit from that. And, you know, and everything was integrated with software. And we had these really, like, super capable scripts that, you know, would allow you to control, you know, a lot like, you know, the APC and the push. We were able to leverage all that same stuff. But, you know, like, you really had to concentrate on this, you know, your computer screen to know where you are and get that feedback. Mm-hmm. And so there's that little bit of that disconnect between your device and the screen. So, you know, I was like, oh God, if we could just like we didn't really want to engineer a screen, you know, for a variety of reasons. And so I started like, you know, working like, well, how can we get that information and just send it, you know, create like a web server and just, you know, you yeah. can just go into a browser. And like, we actually did a prototype of that mm-hmm. and it was super, like, it was great. You just put your phone on the, you know, in front of the controller, and like it wouldn't tell you like what your knobs were mapped to as you navigated around. And
oh, cool.
Yeah. And it was just like, oh, this is super cool. Like this works out really well. But it was no small feat to set up, you know, because mm-hmm. it's like, well, you got to create like a communication from live to, you know, your third party web server, and then your web server has, you know, and it was just like, it worked, you know, once it was going, I was like, okay, this is cool. But it was like, yeah, this is going to be a support nightmare.
Wow.
Yeah. Cause it's just like, it's not like, yeah, all your web developer friends would be like, oh yeah, that's great. But then like,
yeah,
you know, the guy who just wants to make some beats would be like, well, it's not working. It's just like, yeah,
it's not intuitive probably.
It was a little, there were too many clicks and too many steps. But I think something like that is going to be a lot easier. This guy, James Westfall, he did a lot of our scripting for live, and he's done the scripts for Sensel. He knows like all this, like he knows how to reverse engineer like all of the live scripts, and you know, he has a whole framework around this stuff. A lot of this stuff's open source at on GitHub, and he's got like a suite of Maxwell Live devices, and it's kind of like people don't know about him. And I'm like, I'm here to tell you about him. Omha, A-U-M-H-A-A on GitHub. But he's been doing some interesting work with like, you know, sort of like allowing for web servers from, you know, Maxwell Live devices and stuff like that. So I think there's going to be some cool stuff that comes out of that.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well,
Peter, I think we've talked for just over an hour.
Oh, awesome.
It's great, man.
All right, great.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This is fun.
Thank you.